I'm going to start the reading with some excerpts from an untitled, unpublished memoir that I've been working on and off, and in between all the other projects I've been working on the past 3 or 4 years. And since we're talking about Rochester, all of this takes place in Rochester when I was growing up, probably around the ages of between, I'd say, about 6 and 7 years old to about 13, 12 or 13 was when I actually started to seriously get interested in poetry. Right now, that's my cutoff age at the moment. That might change. You know, you come back years later and you realize that your past catches up with you. You know, a teacher from one of the poets in the schools programs I was in when I was teaching in Richmond came and gave me this wonderful reminder of my used to be, me teaching a class, a photo of me back in my 30s. You know, trim and, you know, alert, and, you know, trying to actually teach poetry to this workshop. And you can't see it, but there's this kid in one of the photos. He's leaning back in the chair. He's got his arms like this. His mouth is open. So I must be making a really good point. So this seems appropriate. This is actually the true story of the first time I actually encountered poetry in any way, shape, or form. Poetry. It's Valentine's Day, fourth grade, Nathaniel Rochester, school number 3. Today, we learn about poetry. Mrs. Edwards, our teacher, who is my age now, but very old then, has reached a unit in her teaching guide concerning rhyme and meter. But I already know what I need to know. Like a good kid, my body automatically squirms at the word. Why? Have I ever read a poem before this? No. Neither has any other child in the class, but the word just has that sound about it, like vegetables, that makes us want to shove our hands in our pockets and pout. It's a grown-up word, a suck-the-fun-from-out-of-the-room word, like behave. Every kid winces as if the lips of a dreaded aunt were upon them. Today, class, Mrs. Edwards says in that hopeful tone I've grown to use myself over the years, you will choose a Valentine and write them a poem. But no one loves anybody this morning. The word, poetry, has clammed our affection up. Mrs. Edwards, however, has this going for her. She comes prepared. She is the third teacher we've had so far this year. Our first grew ill or pregnant, our second young, idealistic, maybe fresh from college, only lasted a few days. We could smell her fear. She wanted to be our friend, which is the weakest thing a new teacher could ever do. One afternoon, in the middle of a lesson she knows we're not listening to, her voice begins to crack. Then she begins to sob. Her weeping eyes look out on a class that holds absolutely no pity. 20 odd smug faces asking, "What are you doing here?" She slams her book on the desk and runs. Pleasure buzzes among ourselves. In the war between grown-ups and kids, this day is a lock of Custer's scalp. Mrs. Edwards understands that the only things a fourth grade class will understand is respect earned through little unspecified fear. Some people have a voice that tells a kid, don't try it. Mrs. Edwards lets us hear this voice on her first day with us. This is why, for this new exercise, we will moan quietly in our heads and take out a sheet of paper. Poetry. Mrs. Edwards, not wanting to waste all morning on this, has taken pity on us by writing out a group of words on the blackboard that end in the letter S. Use the words on the board, she says, to write your poem. Give the poem to your Valentine, or if you're too shy, to Mrs. Edwards, who will pin them unsigned on the bulletin board. Poetry. Our dumb pencils skate the paper, we shift in our seats, we sniffle bored. Why do they ask this stuff of us? What do they want to know? How nosy can you get? Out of the forced near silence, the low rumble of buildings in the other classrooms, the sound of fingers brushing away erased words, the awful tick of the wall clock, come 4 lines into my head. S.O.S. I'm in a mess, and I need you, I must confess. Is that it? Is this what she wants? I'd rather be in gym class, bunched up in a corner with the rest of the skinny boys, fighting for our lives against the jocks in a game of dodgeball. Good, says Mrs. Edwards when she reads it. Where does it go? Into some young girl's hand who couldn't care less, and I don't remember, and somehow, somewhere, deep in my wannabe a soldier, fireman, doctor head. I'm going to read a couple of newer poems. As people know, I live in New York City now, and of course, we just went through the events of September 11th, and it's been sort of interesting to sort of respond to that. It's also been interesting because I've also had a lot of different friends and close colleagues die as well, separate from the events of September 11th. So there's been a lot of, coming out of me, a lot of elegy poems. I'm going to read a few of those. Hard-headed weather. One. These leaves which have yellowed and are aloft are waving like bright hands at their stem as I drive my small red car under this raw and whipped November sky, and the wag of the bare branch, the argument between the wind and what the wind desires to push, the sleet, the hard-headed weather, this landscape curling towards sleep. Two. A year has passed since you died, and you died, and you. I steer towards my house upstate. Friends, who ever thought that I'd own doors you won't open, floors never to carry your tread? Three. My CD player does this random shuffle. A traditional folk song rumbles the glass, and I think of Whitman nursing his wounded boys at the military hospital, his poetic romance of death now a kid's thirty breath he can't repair, or a young hand he grips until all the possibility in it lays cold. Here is my middle-aged throat, singing along as I drive, singing to you. Pre-war. You left as the war began, in the November wind off the mountain, an American flag left behind by the previous owners of our house flits above the lawn, brave laundry among bare branches. Fall loses its grip. I am arrested by the way the mid-morning breeze and sun illuminates the needles of the pine trees, the first dust of snow. Wait, speaks the dead needles and leaves on the grass. Wait, hushes the smoke from the chimney. Actions have been flung into motion, and soon I will see what everyone left, the dying you missed by dying. Grief bird. After those buildings fell, and New York City stank from bad intent, and the wind twirled with human pigment, and the sky darkened in one spot and howled, there we walked, newborn, holding flashlights and shovels, dusty with shock, the streets painted mad, ears still smarting from the evil crumble. Now the combing, the sifting, now the hauling, the uncovering, the astonished song. Actually, one that's not a grief poem. When I started Brutal Imagination, which I'm going to read some poems from later, there was this little subtext I started to do where basically other fictional black iconic characters started to comment on the story of the Susan Smith case. And some of these characters and some of these things were inanimate objects, and this is one of those poems that are inanimate object. Harriet Tubman's Rock. I held visions. I too was chosen and tossed against my say-so. Who knew I'd be carried all those years, or my kiss could form a scar on her forehead, or that I'd sing to her at unwelcome times. Our meeting was brief. A rough hand wished her dead and aimed. I startled and fell. Here I nest, spent in the field, special among my kind. Her hard lesson, her God flint. Now I'm going to read a couple of poems from Gathering of My Name. One of the things that I thought was really interesting about, again, about history, is that this poem, which I'm about to read, which is called The Supremes, which is really about upward mobility and the reason why people saw it as an escape route out of the ghetto. I read this poem at a reading in New York like 2 years ago, and I was approached by two grad students from the University of Alabama. For some reason, they had come up to New York and decided to catch my reading because I'd been at the University of Alabama in 1991-92 as writer in residence. And they came up to me with all sorts of questions about the Supremes, because since I had left, they'd been teaching the poem. I'll read the poem, I'll tell you what the story goes. It's the Supremes. We were born to be gray. We went to school, sat in rows, ate white bread, looked at the floor a lot. In the back of our small heads, a long scream. We did what we could, and all we could do was turn on each other. How the fat kids suffered. Not even being jolly could save them. And then there were the anal retentives, the terrified brown noses, the desperately athletic or popular. This, of course, was training. At home, our parents shook their heads and waited. We learned of the Industrial Revolution, the sectioning of the clock into pie slices. We drank Cokes and twiddled our thumbs. In the back of our minds, a long scream. We snapped butts in the showers, froze out shy girls on the dance floor, pinpointed flaws like radar. Slowly, we understood this was to be the world. We were born insurance salesmen and secretaries, housewives and short order cooks, stockroom boys and repairmen. And it wouldn't be a bad life, they promised, in a tone of voice that would force some of us to reach in self-defense for wigs, lipstick, sequins. So, of course, it's about my confused sexuality. This is how they're teaching the poem at the University of Alabama now, right? Wigs, lipstick, sequins. Welcome to the postmodern world, friends. You know? Anyway. Upward mobility? Yeah. This is the title poem from Vincent Leigh's Dance Craze. I'm going to read some poems from here, which I haven't done in a while. But I'm going to read this for a number of reasons. One, because it's one of my favorite books, but also because the poems were born here at Sweetbriar. I wrote them in Virginia at Sweetbriar. This is totally a Virginia book. Victims of the Leigh's Dance Craze. The streamers choking the main arteries of downtown, the brass band led by a child from the home for the handicapped, the old men showing their hair, what's left of it, the buttons of their shirts popping in time to the salsa flooding out of their portable headphones, and mothers letting their babies be held by strangers, and the bus drivers tipping over their fare boxes and willing to give directions. Is there any reason to mention all of the drinks are on the house? Thick adolescent boys dismantle their BB guns. Here is the world, what's left of it, in brilliant motion. The oil slick at the curb danced into 1,000 splintered steps. The bag ladies toss off their garments to reveal wings. This dance you do, drawls the cop. What do you call it? We call it scalding the air. We call it dying with your shoes on. And across the street, the bodies of tramps stumble in a sober language. And across the street, shy young girls step behind their nameless boyfriends, twirling their skirts. And under an archway, a delivery boy discovers his body has learned to speak. And what does this street look like if not a runway, a polished wood floor? From the air, insects drawn by the sweat, a light when possible. On the blur of torsos, it is the ride of their tiny lives. The wind that burns their wings, the heaving, oblivious flesh, mountains stuffed with panic, an ocean that can't make up its mind. They drop away with the scorched taste of vertigo. And under a swinging light bulb, some children invent a game with the shadow the bulb makes and the beat of their hearts. They call it dust in the mouth. They call it horse with no rider, they call it school with empty books. In the next room, their mother throws her dress away to chance. It drops to the floor like a brush sighs across a drum head. And when she takes her lover, what are they thinking of if not a ballroom filled with mirrors, a world where no one has the right to stumble? In a parking lot, an old man says this, I am a ghost dance. I remember the way my hair felt, damp with sweat and wind. When the wind kisses the leaves, I am dancing. When the subway hits the third rail, I am dancing. When the barrel goes over Niagara Falls, I am dancing. Music rings my bones like metal. Oh, jazz has come from heaven, he says. At the Z, he jumps, arcing his back like a heron's neck, and stands suddenly revealed as a balance demon, a home for sets and hats. We have all caught the itch, the neon artist wiring up his legs, the tourist couple recording the twist on their Instamatic camera, and in a factory, a janitor asks his broom for a waltz, and he grasps it like a woman he'd have to live another life to meet, and he spins around the dustbin and machines and thinks, is everybody happy? and he spins out the side door, avoiding the cracks on the sidewalk, grinning as if he just received the deepest kiss in the world. April. Suddenly, the legs want a different sort of work. This is because the eyes look out the window and the sight is filled with hope. This is because the eyes look out the window and the street looks a fraction better than the day before. This is what the eyes tell the legs, whose joints become smeared with a fresh sap which would bud if attached to a different limb. The legs want a different sort of work. This is because the ears hear what they've been waiting for, which cannot be described in words, but makes the heart beat faster, as if one had just found money in the street. The legs want to put on a show for the entire world. The legs want to reclaim their gracefulness. This is because the nose at last finds the right scent and tugs the protesting body onto the dance floor. This is because the hands stretching out in boredom accidentally brush against the skirts of the world. Johnny laces up his red shoes. If Fred Astaire had been really smart, he would have danced like Johnny dances on Friday night with his brilliant red shoes that women can detect half a block away. If Fred Astaire had been all he was cracked up to be, he would have danced like Johnny dances on Friday night on two pools of quicksilver painted fire engine red. Johnny is lacing up his red shoes. He is a pizza, a kiss in the dark, and as his fingers tie the laces, he thinks of long, dark hair. On his bittersweet sofa bed, Johnny is lacing up his red shoes, and as his fingers tighten the laces, his work clothes slide deeper into the evening shadows. If Fred Astaire had been serious, he would have walked through the door of the neighborhood bar like Johnny does on Friday night, wearing two small volcanoes that are permitted to erupt for only 3 nights. November. Everything fails. God damn this cold and the static electricity. Like the leaves, I have given up. Words have become a jelly-like substance at the base of the skull. It is another thing I haven't asked for. I take what I get, and what I've got is a lawn filled with surrender, snakeskins, shipwrecks, a porch littered with consequence and scientific fact. This is a gravity dance. The same thing that draws us together has ruined all these dresses. Jazz dancer. I have a theory about motion. I have a theory about the air. I have a theory about main arteries and bass lines. It's a theory, mind you, about Friday night and a dry mouth and certain kinds of thirst and a once-a-month bulge of money in a working pair of pants. I have a theory about kisses. The way a woman draws a man across a dance floor like a ship approaching a new world. I have a theory about space and what's between the space, and an idea about words, a theory about balance and the alphabet, a theory concerning electricity and the tendons, a hunch about long glances from across the ballroom, even though there's a man on her arm, even though there's a woman on his arm, and fire and the ocean, stars and earthquakes, explosions as sharp as new clothes off the rack. When I leap, brushes strike the lip of a cymbal. When I leap, a nerve cuts through glass. When I leap, a thick finger dreams on a bass string. And all that sweat, all that spittle, all those cigarettes and cheap liquor, all that light-hearted sass and volcanism, all that volatile lipstick, all that cleaves the air the way a man and woman sweet talk in a bed. When I leap, I briefly see the world as it is and as it should be, and the street where I grew up, the saxophones, kisses, and mysteries among the houses, and my sister dressing in front of her mirror, a secret weapon of sound and motion, a missionary in the war against the obvious. One more dance poem. Crows in a strong wind. Off go the crows from the roof. The crows can't hold on. They might as well be perched on an oil slick. Such an awkward dance, these gentlemen in their spottled black coats. Such a tipsy dance, as if they didn't know where they were. Such a humorous dance, as they try to set things right, as the wind reduces them. Such a sorrowful dance. How embarrassing is love when it goes wrong in front of everyone. This is a couple of jazz poems. This is about Thelonious Monk, my favorite pianist, one of my favorite jazz pianists. And I read this poem once, an earlier draft of it, at an upstate New York prison. In the original draft, the line I'm about to read is, the motion frozen in these skyscrapers that can't be sung. And the reason I put skyscrapers in was because I was trying to make this connection between Thelonious' music and modern architecture. After my reading, this convict took me aside, and he wanted to explain something to me. And of course, you want to always pay attention to a convict who's trying to tell you something in a prison. And he said,
about Thelonious Monk, don't you?
And then you're in that awkward situation because you're black and you've written about jazz. Suddenly, that's an idea that suddenly you're an expert, right? That you really, as Moses, you really know all about jazz. And suddenly you have that dilemma of basically, do you pretend that you really know what he's about to say, or do you? And I went, and he said, well, you know, I grew up in Thelonious' neighborhood, man. And I tell you what, Thelonious would be walking down the street. And Thelonious, you see a lamppost. He'd go over to the lamppost, and he'd put his ear against the lamppost, and he'd listen to the hum. And then he'd go home, and he'd try to play the hum. When you start writing about jazz long enough, you start to realize at a certain point that true stories don't matter, right? Right. That it really doesn't matter whether that's a true story or not, but because it's about the loneliness, it might as well be a true story. So out of respect to that convict, I changed the line, I changed the word in my next draft. Thelonious Monk. I know what to do with math. Listen to this. It's arithmetic, a soundtrack. The motion frozen in these skyscrapers, it can be sung. I can lift away its logic, make it spin like an orbital satellite. Fine gambling's true pitch. It can be played. Adventure. The trying of patience. Holding back, holding up, laying out, stop. Time, slow motion, time travel, space walking. It can be splintered, strained to the fine mesh of a second. Now I try a few bars of what's next. Run it over my hands. Ignite it. Make the fire. Sound like April in Paris. This is about Hank Mobley, who was a tenor saxophonist, who was unfortunately around the same era that John Coltrane was. And so, unfortunately, when he died, he was considered the poor man's John Coltrane, which is totally unfair. It's too bad. This is a Richmond poem. I actually found out about Hank's death in a used record store here in Richmond. I just was browsing one day and picked up this album, and there was this guy who seemed to be, that's how I got the news that he had died. He died a few years before the album came out, and he didn't die well. He got very ill, had to sell his horns, and died. Hank Mobley's. Sorry, Hank. Found out the hard way. Back of an album cover. Browsing in a record store, it's the wrong way to find out. The guy who wrote the notes on the liner was pissed. It appears that a lot of papers decided not to run an obit, since by then you were not quite John Coltrane. So this poem could be about the breaks. And this poem could be about fire, or the lack of it. Or this poem could deal with the also-rans, you know, the joke about the guy who invents 1 through 6 up and quits, throws up his hands in desperation. But it was your breath in my ears as I stood there, dumbly speaking to whom? Why Was I Born? A duet between John Coltrane and Kenny Burrell. So why, asked the guitarist and the saxophonist, a genius, a lover, sidesteps the question, blows a kiss instead. Then they both begin to speak like bourbon being poured into a glass. At which bar? The eternal one, bathed in the open light of the test pattern, the one where the phone booths are all functional. But so, better here than your shitty apartment his, her scent on the bed's sheets until wash day, perhaps longer, better here than fighting lipstick on a bedroom glass, his brand of cigarette on the dresser. Their melody is the touch you now wish you'd never learned, the caress of fingers and breath that promise, promise. What hurts is beautiful. The bruise of the lyric. Photo of Miles Davis at Lenny's on the Turnpike, 1968. New York grows slimmer in his absence, I suppose. You could also title this picture of Miles, his leathery squint, the grace in his fingers, a sliver of the stuff you can't get anymore. As the rest of us wonder, what was the name of the driver of that truck? And the rest of us sigh, death is one hell of a pickpocket.